The following preview is of a graphic audio production rated for mature audiences due to scenes of intense violence and sexual situations.
There's some kind of trouble at Stack Island. Apparently personnel are missing, believe lost at sea. We're to join the search. All right, we're going down.
Who are you?
Chief Stivers. And you are the missing Corporal Meharry? Where's Commander Bakarian?
She's dead, sir.
You had something to tell us?
Yes, sir. Commander Bakarian was one of Lupescu's followers.
Admiral Lupescu was using prisoners as prey. He was part of a secret society that held manhunts. They used human ears as recognition symbols.
Commander Bakarian's not in our offices, sir. The commander's not answering any call and the locator's not lit.
Ready to initiate bubble bath.
But sir...
Did you earn your ears, Sergeant?
Yes, sir.
Then hop to it.
They've got the orbital station. Bonartig picked up convicts from Stack 3 with its LACs and armed them. Use them as shock troops.
I'm a weapons specialist. I was on my way to Stack 2 to consult on the progress of some of their research. I happen to know that there are weapons under development there which you do not want the mutineers to have. If I were you, I'd figure out a way to send some troops out there to secure the base.
But we have no weather data, which is going to make it hard to fly from one base to another.
Commander, I'm telling you, if you don't secure that base and keep the mutiny from getting hold of those weapons, you'll wish you had to the end of your life.
There's something you must know.
Yes, sir?
You know the official history of the regular space service, how it is an amalgam of the private space-going militias of the founding families? The family we served was based on a single planet. That planet was Altiplano, your world. And, Esme Suiza, it's clear that your ancestors earned the enmity of mine by rebelling against their patrons and slaughtering them all.
What?
I don't believe it. I love her, and I admire her, and I'm going to marry her if I have to leave the family to do it.
There's been a mutiny on Copper Mountain. All leaves canceled. All personnel returned to their ships at once.
Nothing lasts forever.
I hope so.
Let's go.
Serrano Legacy, Book 6, Change of Command, Part 2. From Graphic Audio.
Graphic Audio. A movie in your mind.
Graphic Audio presents James Axler's Outlanders. Narrated by Terrence Aselford. With performances by Nanette Savard, Thomas Penny, Richard Rowan, Colleen Delaney, Dolores King-Williams, David Coyne, James Konacek, Margie Tompros, Andy Clements, Michael John Casey, Lily Beacon, Michael Glenn, Casey Platt, Christopher Graybill, Tim Getman, Joe Brack, Dylan Lynch, and Peter Stray. Outlanders number 47, Death Cry. It was snowing in North Dakota. Wrapped in a light jacket over his shadow suit, Kane hunkered down beneath the snow-laden branches of a fir tree, watching two guards patrol outside the mine entrance. Kane was a tall man, built like a wolf, all muscle piled at the upper half of his body, while his arms and legs were long and rangy. He wasn't cold. In fact, the jacket was worn more for camouflage and for the convenience of extra pockets while on a mission. The tight-fitting one-piece shadow suit he wore beneath served as an artificially controlled environment, regulating his body temperature. It also possessed other useful properties, most crucially acting as armor in the event of an attack. Despite this, the suit allowed for remarkable freedom of movement. Kane turned to look behind him, sensing the approach of his partner. Grant, an ex-magistrate like Kane, held his massive body low against the fluttering snow as he jogged toward the hiding place. He was a huge man, all of his bulk muscle, without an inch of fat. His skin was like polished ebony, and a drooping gunslinger's mustache brushed his top lip. Like Kane, Grant wore a white jacket over his shadow suit, camouflage for the snow-covered landscape, with a white beanie hat pulled low over his head. They hadn't expected to need camouflage. When Lakesh had outlined the mission back at the Cerberus Redoubt, he had made no mention of other parties being interested in the acquisition. Straight in and out, don't let the delicate structure collapse on you as you pass through. The delicate structure in question was a long-buried Air Force base, predating the nuke cost, in a town that had once been called Grand Forks. Close to the old Canadian border, from a time when country borders meant something, rumor had it that the base had been used as a backup data storage facility. Now all that remained was a pile of rubble that served as firewood for the local roamers. But Mohandas Lakesh Singh, the nominal head of the Cerberus exiles, had recently stumbled upon evidence that suggested some useful data may have been stored at the Grand Forks base, data that might not have survived in other forms. A quick look-see and they'd be out, or so Lakesh had said to Kane's three strong survey crew. A pair of guards patrolled the mine-like entrance that led into the old underground network of the abandoned Air Force base.
It's the same all over, Kane. Guards everywhere. Not many, but plenty enough if they want to make trouble for us.
That's what I suspected. You see any other ways in?
No. Looks like the Millennialists have provided the best and only entryway to our buried treasure.
The Millennialists, or more properly, members of the Millennial Consortium, were treasure hunters with a solid organizational structure and plenty of backup for their field ops. They dealt in pre-nuke cost materiel, mostly military ordnance, which they would either sell to the highest bidder or use for their own political ends, quite often both at once. If the Millennialists could get someone else to do their dirty work and pay for the pleasure in the process, so much the better. Kane and Grant had come to blows with the Millennial Consortium a few times, both in America and elsewhere across the globe. Despite claiming noble aims, most who belonged to the Millennial Consortium were opportunistic pirates, bottom feeders of the worst sort as far as Kane was concerned. Their bold agenda listed a desire to restore civilization to the country, but there was no doubt in Kane's mind that they'd sell him their own grandmothers. Three Scorponauts, the preferred land vehicles of the Millennialists, were parked close to the squared-off entrance. The low-slung, box-like vehicles moved on eight heavily tracked wheels and were sturdily armored. They sported numerous rocket pods and weapons ports, and 50-caliber swivel-mounted machine guns stuck out from two armatures at the front of the vehicles like a pair of foreclaws. The 10-foot-long snout of a 40-millimeter cannon protruded from the rear on a huge, swiveling arm, docking in a resting position at the back of the vehicles, resembling a scorpion's stinger-tipped tail. Seeing three of them there meant one thing. It was a lightly manned rather than a priority operation. Kane noticed the misting puff of disturbed snow off to the right, at the edge of his sight, and he turned to see the third member of his team, Bridget Baptiste, making determined headway through the thick carpet of white as she came to join them. A striking woman, Bridget had hidden her vibrant red-gold hair beneath a white scarf, leaving her pale face clear. Her high forehead pointed to intellect, while her full lips suggested a passionate side to her personality. Wrapped in a white jacket with a sable collar similar to those worn by her colleagues, hair masked, and the cold draining the color from her face and lips, Bridget's bright emerald eyes and thin ginger eyebrows were a little flash of color in the pale surroundings. She shook her head as she crouched with Kane and Grant beneath the low-hanging branches.
No good.
No back door.
Kane continued to watch the entrance to the underground structure. The roughly built square tunnel was boxed with wooden struts and rusty, paint-flecked metal poles.
Guess we're going in the front, then.
No way, Kane. I'll always back your play, but look at them. Walking in there would be suicide, plain and simple.
The entrance is too well guarded, Kane. We can't just sneak past them. And there are too many to just start blasting people, even if that was a reasonable option. Face it, the scavengers have won this round. Maybe we'll be able to buy the tech from them sometime later on.
Oh, ye of little faith. You're always telling us how we need to use our guns less and diplomacy more, Baptiste.
I don't see what...
Kane unclipped something from the built-in belt of his jacket. He stepped out of the tree cover and walked down the slight slope toward the mine entrance, holding aloft the small gunmetal canister with his thumb pushed tightly against its circular top.
Everybody relax.
The confused guards raised their rifles toward him.
This is what's known as a dead man switch. You all know what that means, so lower the weapons.
The two guards nodded and tentatively lowered their blasters, still clutching them in readiness. Their outfits were patched together, not uniforms as such, but uniform in their raggedness. Both had heavy fur hats pulled low to their brows, and their hands were wrapped in dirty gloves or bundled in rags.
Now, I and my friends here have some business inside. We don't plan to be long, and we don't intend to take much. But if we don't get our way, then you and I and this whole underground shaft thing you have going on are about to meet the glorious Maker and sing hallelujah.
Bridget looked annoyed as she followed Grant out from beneath the tree.
This is what he calls diplomacy?
If I'm not mistaken, he's threatening them with a flask of water, Bridget.
Grant tensed the tendons of his right wrist, and his Sin-Eater sidearm was thrust into his hand from beneath his right sleeve. The Sin-Eater was the official sidearm of the Magistrate Division, and both Grant and Kane had kept them when they had fled from Cobaltville. The Sin-Eater was an automatic hand blaster, less than 14 inches in length at full extension, firing 9mm rounds. The whole unit folded in on itself to be stored in a bulky holster just above the user's wrist. The holsters reacted to a specific flinching of the wrist tendons, powering the pistol automatically into the user's hand. If the index finger was crooked at the time, the hand blaster would begin firing automatically. The trigger had no guard. As mags, Grant and Kane were schooled in the use of numerous different weapons, but both of them still felt especially comfortable with the Sin-Eater in hand. It was an old friend, a natural weight to their movements. Just now, Kane's own Sin-Eater was still sheathed in its wrist holster beneath the white sleeve of his coat. He paced forward, holding the flask aloft and keeping the attention of the two guards as they wondered whether to leave their posts.
I want you all to step away from the entrance.
Grant leveled his Sin-Eater meaningfully at the guards, holding it for a second first on the one to the left, then tracking swiftly across and pointing it at the other guard before returning to the first one once more.
Guns in the snow, gentlemen.
Maniacs.
How many are inside?
Come on, kid. Quickly now.
8.
You got a way to speak to them?
Shouting. Just shouting.
No radios? No comm devices?
Only in the Scorponauts.
To communicate with home. Nothing for here.
This rang true to Kane and his team. The Millennial Consortium was not renowned for its lavish treatment of staff. Its operations were executed at minimal expense to generate maximum profits. Low-ceilinged, the tunnel dipped into a shallow slope, burrowing under the wrecked firewood and open foundations that had once formed buildings above. Kane could see a few paces into the tunnel, after which its contents were lost in darkness.
My buddies and I are going to go in. You're going to wait here, and you're not going to do anything stupid, or we will all be having the remainder of this discussion in the afterlife. Am I clear?
The guards nodded, their eyes wide in fear, but Kane didn't bother turning to them. He was busy scanning the gloom of the tunnel and listening for any hint of approaching reinforcements.
Now, if nobody does anything unwise, like trying to use a weapon, nobody'll get hurt. We'll be out of your hair before you know it.
He led the way into the tunnel. Grant held back, covering the two guards with his Sin-Eater, as Bridget followed Kane into the dark tunnel.
Sit tight, boys. We won't be here long.
With that, Grant ducked his head and jogged the few steps it took him to catch up to his colleagues. Bridget looked from Grant to Kane.
This is insane, you realize.
We're in, and nobody's been hurt so far. Score 1 for diplomacy, I think.
The pair of you seem to have mistaken diplomacy for insanity.
Whoa there. This is strictly Kane's insanity. I just follow the leader.
So you plan to bluff your way inside, and then what?
I'll insist they all leave, or I'll set off the bomb.
What bomb? You're holding a flask.
They don't need to know that.
I'd say it's preferable if they don't know it.
If they're scared by the loco bomber, then they all wait outside at a safe distance, and we get the place to ourselves. You find what you need, then we head back to Lakesh and Cerberus.
Brilliant. And what, pray tell, is your plan for getting out again? With maybe 15 armed and now very much antagonized millennialists waiting for us at the end of a bottleneck.
This used to be a military base, right, Baptiste? We'll use their Matrans. Simple, and yet genius.
The Matrans chamber was found in many of the pre-nuke-cost military bases and offered a quick way to move from one to the other by the almost instantaneous transfer of particles. Having been originally constructed as a military installation, the Cerberus Redoubt, the headquarters of Kane's field team, had a MET-TRANS chamber. However, they had traveled to Grand Forks via two Manta Flyers, which acted as both transatmospheric and subspace aircraft. It would be a simple matter, Kane reasoned, to collect the hidden Mantas once the heat had died down. The Cerberus exiles had a variety of ways to transport people. The Manta aircraft and the MET-TRANS network were just two. In the past few years, they had come to rely increasingly on another form of teleportation called the Interphaser, which exploited naturally occurring centers of energy both around the world and on the moon and other planets. The Interphaser was ideal for traveling between known locations, but like the MET-TRANS, could be dangerous when gating into the unknown. There were other limitations on the Interphaser as well, but for the right mission, it was ideal.
Nothing can go wrong with this, can it?
Not unless he drinks the bomb by mistake.
Kane led the way along the ill-lit tunnel, assuming the role of point man. Taking point was an unconscious habit for Kane, dating back to his days as a magistrate. He exhibited an uncanny knack for sniffing out danger, a sixth sense in some respect, though it was really an incredible combination of the natural five he possessed, honed to an acute sharpness. Walking point, his eyes darting right and left, his hearing seeking changes in sound at an almost infinitesimal level, Kane felt electric, tuned in to his surroundings at a near zen-like level. Walking point in the danger zone, Kane felt alive. By the time they reached the concrete exterior of the base itself, even Bridget was feeling quietly confident. At the end of the shaft, a huge circular hole had been bored through the thick concrete wall of the old military base, taller than Grant and wide enough for two people abreast. Kane and Grant led the way into the interior, finding it lit by a string of dim, flickering lights that had been attached to vicious-looking hooks rammed into the ceiling. The whole system had to be running off a generator of some kind, installed specially for the Millennial Consortium operation. Large gaps between the flickering lights left sections of the corridor in complete darkness.
No expense spared.
The first thing Bridget noticed as she stepped into the underground lair was the stench of stale air. Slushy, muddy prints could be seen on the tiles beneath her feet, and there was a little mound of pale-colored powder where the hole had been drilled through the wall. She checked behind her, peering into the dark shaft they had just walked through to make sure no one had followed them.
Know where we're going, Baptiste?
Bridget had an eidetic memory, long ago more commonly known as a photographic memory, and she'd studied maps of the Grand Forks base before leaving for the mission. She pointed to the left corridor.
Computer core's a little down this way, 20 paces maybe.
As they got closer, Bridget indicated a set of double doors to one side, and Kane locked eyes with Grant, putting a finger to the side of his nose for a moment before they led the way inside. The gesture was a private code between the two X-Mags, an old tradition to do with luck and long odds. Kane quickly entered the gloomy, smoke-damaged computer room, his hand holding the gunmetal flask prominently out before him like a shield. There were three guards in the room, but none of them was watching the door as he moved through it.
Hello, gentlemen.
The three guards spun to face the intruders, reaching for their sidearms.
Freeze! Dead man switch here. That means if I'm dead, you're dead.
Two other men were in the room, and they looked up from their work at the stripped-down computer banks.
Some of you look like scientific types, so I'll put this in terms you're all familiar with. Get out of here or I will blow us all up. Any questions?
One of the guards pointed his Coleco M960 subgun at Kane.
What's to stop me offing you right now?
The other people in the room looked at the guard for a moment, horror on their faces.
Do what he says. That's a dead man switch.
He'll kill us all.
He's bluffing. I'll get his arm.
Are you nuts?
Look, we don't have time to argue about this. Make your decision now. Either get out or stay here and get blown up. Don't complicate the very simple set of options I'm giving you.
One of the white coats, a bespectacled man with thin blonde hair, stepped forward.
This is highly unusual. Our section leader would be terribly upset if we were to just leave this operation.
Grant took a step forward and grabbed the blonde scientist by his collar, ramming the nose of his sin-eater in the man's terrified face.
My partner here is holding a bomb. You don't give a crap how upset your boss is going to be.
Grant tossed the man aside. The other scientist, a man with a round face and the black hair and gold skin of an Asian, faced his colleagues.
There's only three of them. How much can they take? This isn't worth getting blown up over.
Smart man. All of you can get out of here now, and you have my word that we won't shoot you in the back or anything like that.
Warily, the guards and scientists made their way from the room. Grant followed them, the sin-eater poised in his hand.
Keep going through the tunnel to the outside.
Grant watched them leave, walking down the corridor with heavy heads. Inside the computer room, Kane was clipping the flask to his belt.
You know, Baptiste, I could get used to this diplomacy thing.
You were lucky.
Bridget stepped toward one of the computer terminals.
Well, they've got juice going to the computers, at least.
Grant re-entered the computer room.
I need you to find us that Mad-Trans, Grant. I want to be out of here in 10 minutes.
10? Kane, that's impossible. I can't get into this network in 10 minutes.
This bluff won't last long, Baptiste. 10 minutes is the absolute maximum we have here.
She nodded and went back to work on the keyboard, pulling a pair of small, square-framed spectacles from her inside pocket and propping them on her nose as the screen before her came to life. Grant stepped back to the double doors, turning back to address Bridget.
I saw a map on the wall a ways back. Do you know roughly where this Mad-Trans is, Bridget?
Bridget didn't look up as the scrolling figures rushed across the screen before her.
Not sure. I don't think it was on the part of the map I looked at.
Get back to the map and look for anything that says transport. The Mad-Trans gateway won't be far.
Grant ducked through the door and jogged back down the corridor to the wall map.
You realize that this won't work, Kane.
How's that?
This is a 200-year-old computer running off a generator. Whatever's inside is encrypted up the wazoo. I don't know what it is I'm looking for anyway, and now you tell me we only have 10 minutes. I thought we'd have maybe an afternoon here, do a rec, and come back at a later date, once we had decided what it was we were looking at. You're the one who got all gung-ho and decided to threaten armed people with a bomb unless you got your own damn way.
Hey, I had to improvise, Baptiste.
Outside the computer room, Grant made his way back along the corridor to the place where he had seen the map. A large, color-coded illustration, the map set behind hard, transparent plastic to one side of a T-junction corridor that disappeared farther into the disused military base. Leaning close as the overhead light flickered, Grant swept grime from the plastic covering with the edge of his free hand before wiping the hand on his pant leg. The map showed 5 different colored sections that formed a bulging rectangular shape. The key on the right-hand side of the map gave a broad term for what each section represented: green for research, orange for personnel, and so on. Grant looked swiftly over the map and located the computer room he had just come from. Then he carefully ran his finger along the key to the side, reading the names of all the different divisions and subdivisions. He was halfway down the list. He turned to his right, automatically lifting the Sin Eater and pointing it into the darkness of the dusty, ill-lit corridor. Grant realized that if he couldn't see them, then they probably couldn't see him either. Holding the pistol steady, he took a step away from the wall and crouched to make a smaller target. At 250 pounds of solid muscle, it wasn't easy for the big man to make an appreciably smaller target. Grant thought back to the discussion with the millennialist guards outside. They'd said there were 8 people down there, and with the 2 they'd found in the shaft plus the 5 in the computer room, Grant realized that they were still one man short.
Guy chose the wrong time to take a leak.
Grant darted lightly forward along the corridor, his movements quiet and economical. Holding the Sin Eater before him, with his left hand steadying his grip, Grant spotted movement in the dark. Someone was approaching, walking along the corridor toward him. Grant was suddenly very conscious that despite the poor lighting, he was still dressed in a white jacket and hat for the snow. He sank into a crouch, holding the pistol steady as he dropped out of the stranger's potential eyeline. Silhouetted against the flickering light for an instant was a tall, bulky figure reaching for a rifle that was slung from a shoulder strap across his chest.
Who's there? I can see you're there.
A tiny glint of light reflected from the muzzle of the rifle as it swung toward him, and Grant leaped forward, powering himself at the man in a driving rush of coiled muscles, his arms wide as he gripped the man's shoulders. The man's finger twitched on the trigger of his rifle. But Grant was already inside the firing arc, his heavy body crushing the man beneath him. Grant pulled back his right hand, ready to shoot the downed guard, but the man was already unconscious. Grant watched as a trickle of blood seeped across the cracked tile from the back of the gunman's head. He got up and stepped away from the unconscious gunman. He kicked the man's rifle out of sight, holstered his Sin Eater, and returned to the map. Inside the computer room, Bridget's fingers were frantically racing across the keyboard as a stream of digits raced across the screen.
I'm into the basic coding, Kane, but the whole thing is encrypted. Whatever's in here is either very important or it's the diary of a very paranoid teenager.
Remind you of anyone in particular, Baptiste?
No, why?
She looked up, seeing the sly grin on her colleague's face.
Well, don't look at me. Do you think I ever had time to keep a diary when we were in Cobaltville?
Kane took two swift steps across the room to the closed double doors, the sin-eater appearing in his hand. No further noise followed, and Kane risked opening one of the double doors, pushing his back against it as he raised the pistol in his hands.
Grant? Grant, you okay?
Just fine. Rodent problem, but I dealt with it.
Kane stepped back into the room, his pistol returning to his sleeve as he walked across to stand behind Bridget.
I don't feel safe here, Kane.
We'll be out of here in a few minutes.
Just then, Grant came running through the double doors, clutching his sin-eater.
We have got a problem.
What now?
Unless I am very much mistaken, there is no Mattrans in this facility.
Kane and Bridget looked at Grant, their eyes wide as they took in his statement.
No back door, people.
Worst plan ever.
Kane started pacing the computer room like a caged tiger, head low as he tried to think through the situation. He had assumed that this installation would have a Mattrans, but there had been no guarantee of that.
There's got to be a way out, a back door, something.
Bridget watched him over the rims of her glasses as she sat at the computer terminal.
This place has been buried for 200 years, remember? Any back doors that might have existed are long since sealed. Essentially, we're sitting in an archaeological dig.
Then we go out the same way we got here. We use the shaft.
We get the shaft, you mean? You heard what Bridget said when we came in. That route is a bottleneck with 15, maybe 20 armed millennialists just waiting to take a pop at us.
Kane reached for the gunmetal flask that hung from his belt.
So we'll use the same trick, the dead man switch. They won't shoot me while I'm holding the dead man switch.
Oh, yes, they will. One, they know exactly where we're coming from this time. Two, they've had time to think about it. Three, they've had time to set up sharpshooters.
Four, they'll most likely shoot your arm off at the elbow.
Well, what makes you so sure?
Because that's what you'd do.
Yeah, you're right.
Stepping over to the double doors, Grant pushed his way through and glanced warily down the corridor, waving the sin-eater in a slow arc before him. As the lights flickered, he made out the slumped form of the gunman he had disarmed, still lying unconscious close to the rabbit hole exit.
I don't think we have a whole lot of time, either. I met a hostile outside. He's out for the count right now, but...
How's the computer hack going, Baptiste?
Slowly. Even with a villful of luck, it could take all day to stumble on a lead that takes me anywhere. Plus, Lakesh didn't really know what we were looking for. It's like Secret Santa. You hope it's something good, but you have no idea what it's going to be till the wrapping's off.
Kane tilted his head as he assessed the black metallic base of the computer terminal.
Then we'll take the whole unit with us. Can't weigh more than 20, 30 pounds. Shut it down, and let's get the thing unhooked.
Do you know anything about how computers work, Kane? This is a delicate piece of equipment, and it's attached to the wall.
Stow it. It survived the nuke cost and 200 years of dust. We'll take what we can and get out of here alive.
Bridget looked plaintively to Grant, and the huge ex-mag returned her look.
Wrap it up, people.
Kane walked across the room to the double doors.
We're moving out in 2 minutes. Grant, you carry the computer.
With that, Kane disappeared through the doors, sin-eater in hand, to scout the corridor for opposition. Bridget powered down the computer terminal.
He's actually gone insane.
Grant crouched beneath a computer desk and began unplugging connections, including the jury-rigged power that the millennialists had attached to get it running in the first place.
Insane or not, would you trust your life in anyone else's hands?
Bridget didn't even need to think about it. A dozen images jockeyed for position in her mind's eye, situations where Kane had covered her back, taken care of her, and saved her life. 100 further instances were rushing through her head as she helped Grant unwire the base of the computer. Photographic memory could be a double-edged sword when you wanted to be mad at someone.
Any idea how we're getting out of here?
Grant pulled the blocky computer from the desk.
None at all. But I'm not worried. Kane will do something. He always does.
Bridget grabbed the TP-9 pistol from where she had placed it beside her on the desk, and she and Grant walked briskly across the room to the double doors. Kane was waiting for them just by the door, the gunmetal flask back in his hand. Grant took one look at the flask and shook his head.
That'll never work.
Kane started off toward the hole in the wall at a fast trot, trusting the others to keep up.
I've added a little something new this time.
Kane grinned maliciously as he stepped over the unconscious gunman on the floor and headed for the large gap in the wall that led to the boxed tunnel. Grant was right behind him, hefting the computer under his left arm. The black metal-covered unit stretched from beneath his armpit right down to the curled tips of his gripping fingers, and he was forced to keep his arm straight to carry it. They had left the monitor and keyboard behind, knowing they could substitute these items when they reached their headquarters at the Cerberus Redoubt.
This is gonna throw my aim off. I can keep you covered, but I don't think I can do much pinpoint work.
Won't be necessary. Baptiste and I will handle things. Won't wait.
Bridget sight-checked the chamber of her TP-9.
Can't wait.
The three-person reconnaissance team jogged along the shaft, making good speed without exhausting themselves as they worked their way up the muddy incline. They didn't meet anyone along the shaft. They turned a slight corner close to the exit. Kane urged his companions backward, and the Cerberus trio waited just around the corner.
Told you.
Taking point, Kane edged toward the turn in the shaft.
They'll get bored.
Kane drew his right arm back and stepped two paces forward before tossing the gunmetal flask ahead of him like a baseball pitcher. The flask hurtled through the air toward the entrance to the mine shaft.
The dead man switch! Take cover!
Kane ducked behind cover.
Look away. Close your eyes and look away.
All three of them turned to face the underground lair that they had just come from. Even from behind lidded eyes, they could see the bright flash of an explosion.
Okay, come on.
Grant and Bridget chased after Kane as he led the way, Sin Eater in hand, up the last part of the shaft and into the open air. Kane darted out of the entrance. His bullet swept the legs out from under a millennialist guardsman who was rubbing at his eyes.
What the hell did you just do?
I stuffed the flask with flashbangs.
Kane continued running, head low, across the snow-carpeted ground. The millennialists had arranged themselves in a crescent shape across the open entrance in a determined bid to trap the Cerberus exiles inside the shaft and, presumably, contain the expected explosion when the dead man switch was detonated. Bridget aimed her TP-9. Kane mostly fired warning shots rather than aiming at specific targets. The way he saw it, they were pretty much home free with the opposition blinded by the flashbangs. It didn't warrant unnecessary deaths now. The flashbang was a little explosive charge that provided exactly what its name implied, a big flash and a loud bang. Kane and Grant carried various different types of the little capsules, some able to generate copious amounts of smoke or a foul stench upon breaking, and they used them for distraction rather than actually hurting an enemy. The bright glare of the flashbangs could temporarily blind an unsuspecting opponent and make his or her ears ring, but it wouldn't leave any permanent damage. Grant didn't want to think about how many of the little explosive spheres Kane had packed into the flask, but he could see that it had dazzled the millennialists into submission.
Vintage Kane.
Grant chased across the snow after his colleagues, his rolling gait compensating for the weight of the computer unit. The snow was falling more heavily than when they'd entered the shaft, thick flurries obscuring their sight as they rushed up the low hill and past the fir tree that Kane had used for cover. Kane took point, with Bridget and Grant a few paces behind.
What the?
The gunman he had encountered inside the underground lair had awakened and was running after them out of the square shaft entrance. Grant threw himself at the ground, using his right shoulder to cushion his fall. Grant sank into the soft snow, still clutching the computer base unit to his side.
A little help here, guys?
Kane and Bridget stopped running, spinning on their heels and sighting the gunman outside the boxy entrance. Suddenly, the gunman's head snapped back in a spray of crimson. Kane leaned forward to give Grant a hand up. As he pulled the big man back to his feet, a movement caught Kane's eye. He looked up, over Grant's head, and spotted the large black object moving between the ridges of snow like a prowling panther. It was a Scorponaut, one of the tank-like vehicles that the Millennial Consortium employed for field operations, and it was heading their way.
Troops, we've got bigger problems.
He pointed a little to the left of the mine-like entrance, and Grant and Bridget looked where he indicated. Suddenly, the dark shape came into view between two mounds of snow, weaving around a copse as it headed up the slope toward them.
Must have been looking the other way when you set off the flashbangs. Got any ideas?
Yeah. The Mandas are about a click away. We could get there in under 5 minutes without that computer slowing you down.
No, we can't leave it behind after everything we just went through to get it.
Nobody's leaving anything behind, Baptiste. Just need to find a way to give Grant a head start. You guys go on, and I'll catch up as soon as I'm able.
Attention, Rotters! You have stolen properties that belong to the Millennial Consortium by right of salvage. Please cease and desist your current actions and return the property immediately, or we will be forced to reclaim by any means necessary. We urge you to swiftly comply!
Grant started trekking up the slope, shifting the computer beneath his arm as he did so, struggling to secure a firmer grip. Bridget turned to join Grant, the TP-9 still in her hand. Then she stopped and turned back to their team leader.
What are you going to do, Kane?
Late chicken with 5 tons of heavily armed wag by the look of it.
He shrugged out of the white jacket he had worn for camouflage. Then he was off, a dark shadow against the white snow, running back down the slope toward the approaching Scorponaut, the Sin Eater held in his upraised hand. Kane half ran, half jumped down the snow-covered incline, his legs and arms pumping as he made his way toward a group of low trees off to the right of the approaching vehicle. He saw the foreclaws of the unit whir in readiness. Kane leaped and weaved, always moving, giving the crew of the Scorponaut the least possible chance of getting a bead on him. Still running, Kane held the Sin Eater across his body. He kept running to his right, checking over his left shoulder to make sure the vehicle was still following. Wearing the black shadow suit, he wouldn't be hard to spot. And having taken a few shots at the Scorponaut, he figured the crew would be just about mad enough to forget about his colleagues until they had finished with him. Over to the right, at roughly the same height on the snowy bank as he now found himself, Kane saw a pair of trees. Their trunks were thin and their branches loaded with snow like cotton wool. Head down, he forced himself to run faster, kicking his legs high to get clear of the snow that threatened to pull him over or slow him. He aimed his body toward the trees, a plan forming in his mind. Kane felt the shockwave of the explosion as it slammed into the right side of his abdomen and dislodged snow tumbled past him as it slid down the slope. Kane looked back over his left shoulder and saw that the Scorponaut crew had brought the tail cannon into the fray. The flexible cannon arm was doubled back to shoot over the main body of the vehicle, launching its massive shells in his direction. While the crew could not get the swivel arm low enough to hit its target, if enough snow was dislodged, or one of those trees cut down so that it knocked Kane off his feet, then he was done for. He whipped his head back and pushed his body harder, limbs pumping, determined to keep ahead of the approaching vehicle. Bullets riddled the ground as the Scorponaut's foreclaws spit lead at the running figure. Kane skipped to one side, the cold air burning his nostrils and throat. He was almost at the trees, and the Scorponaut was just behind him. In fact, it was so close that suddenly he found himself inside the foreclaws' arc of fire, and he realized, horrified, that the Millennialists would be just as happy to mow him down. The snowfall was turning into a blizzard now, everything becoming white on white, so heavy that Kane could barely see two body lengths ahead of him as he ran. He glanced behind him once more, the dark shadow of the approaching Scorponaut, an ominous presence just behind him. He looked ahead once again to see the two thin trees just feet away. Kane threw himself forward, diving between the tree trunks and hurtling face first into the cushion of the thick snow, bullets racing overhead. The tree trunks were thin, but Kane had judged that they had to be hardy, growing there in the harsh wilds of North Dakota. Still lying on the ground, Kane looked behind him and saw that the Scorponaut was tangled between the sturdy trunks. It had become wedged at an angle, its claws tilted and pointing into the sky at 30 degrees. Good now only for shooting birds, there was no way that the crew would be able to target anything on ground level. Kane smiled as he watched the Millennialists struggling to free their vehicle. Then he pulled himself up, brushing snow from his shadow suit and rolling his shoulders to loosen them after the hard landing. Kane holstered his Sin Eater and made his way back up the hill at a fast jog and continued in the direction of the Mantas. The snowstorm was so heavy that Kane almost ran straight past where the Mantas were stowed, close to a clump of trees. He had assumed he would recognize the formation of the trees, but by the time he got there, they had been covered with thick snow, blending into the white landscape. As he jogged by, Kane spied a flash of sunset red and recognized it for Bridget Baptiste's brightly colored hair. She was brushing snow from her hair and face when he approached, the white scarf now draped loosely over her shoulders.
What kept you?
A little horticulturalism.
Oh, really? Were you picking flowers again?
More rearranging trees.
Grant appeared from inside one of the Manta craft, and he slid down the subtle curve of its bronze-hued wing. The two strange aircraft were parked in the clearing by the trees. They had the general shape and configuration of seagoing manta rays, flattened wedges with graceful wings curved out from their bodies to a span of 20 yards, with a body length of close to 15 yards and a slight elongated hump in the center as the only evidence of the cockpit location. Curious geometric designs covered almost the entire exterior surface of each craft, with elaborate cuneiform markings, swirling glyphs, and cup and spiral symbols all over. The Mantas were propelled by two different kinds of engine, a ramjet and solid-fuel pulse detonation air spikes.
Computer's all packed. You ready to move out?
I think we've pretty much outstayed our welcome.
He knew that they wouldn't be able to navigate in this horrendous weather by sight alone, but the remarkable transatmospheric vehicles had a dizzying array of onboard sensors that would alert them to any danger long before they eyeballed it. Bridget leaped into the Manta behind Kane, in the same spot that Grant had secured the computer in his own vehicle. The Cerberus Redoubt was far from Grand Forks, to the west. When a weary-looking Kane, Grant, and Bridget entered the ops center of the Cerberus Redoubt, Dr. Mohandas Lakesh Singh rose from his swivel chair and rushed across the large room to greet them.
"It is good to see you in such rude health," called Lakesh by those who knew him.
The doctor appeared to be a man of perhaps 50 years of age. He was a distinguished man who held himself upright, with an aquiline nose and refined mouth, dusky skin and sleek black hair showing the first hints of white at the temples. However, Lakesh was older than he appeared, much older. He had been a physicist and cyberneticist for the U.S. military before the nuke cost back in 2001, and had spent much of his life in cryogenic suspension. The ops room was large, with a vast Mercator relief map of the world spanning one wall, forming a panorama over the wide door through which the field team entered. The map included more than 100 tiny lights, each illustrating a point where a known operational MATTRANS unit was located. A plethora of colored lines linked them in a representation of the Cerberus network, the central concern of the redoubt when it had been built over 200 years before. Strictly speaking, Cerberus was a nickname for the headquarters. Like all of the military redoubts, this one had been named for a phonetic letter of the alphabet, as used in radio communications. Somewhere in the long-forgotten computer logs and paper files stored deep within the three-story complex, Cerberus was still Redoubt Bravo, a facility dedicated to monitoring the use of the miraculous MATTRANS network. But lost somewhere in the mists of time, a young soldier had painted a vibrant illustration of a vicious two-headed hound guarding the doors to the redoubt, like Cerberus at the gates of the underworld. The soldier was long since forgotten, but his bold version of the hellhound lived on as a lucky charm and a mascot to the 60-plus residents of the complex. The redoubt was located high in the Bitterroot Range in Montana, where it had remained forgotten or ignored in the two centuries since the nuke cost. In the years since that nuclear devastation, a strange mythology had grown up around the mountains, with their dark, foreboding forests and seemingly bottomless ravines. The wilderness area surrounding the redoubt was virtually unpopulated. The nearest settlement was to be found in the flatlands some miles away, consisting of a small band of Indians, Sioux and Cheyenne, led by a shaman named Sky Dog. Tucked beneath camouflage netting, hidden away within the rocky clefts of the mountains, concealed uplinks chattered continuously with two orbiting satellites that provided much of the empirical data for Lakesh and his team. Maintaining and expanding access to the satellites had taken long hours of intense trial and error work by many of the top scientists on hand at the base. Now, Lakesh and his team could draw on live feeds from an orbiting Vela-class reconnaissance satellite and the Keyhole Comsat. Despite delays associated with satellite communication, this arrangement allowed access to data surveying the surface of the planet, as well as the ability to communicate with field teams. The high-ceilinged ops room was indirectly lit to better allow the computer operators to see their screens without suffering glare or obtrusive reflections. Two aisles of computer terminals stretched across the room, although a number of these currently stood unused. The control center was the brain of the redoubt, and Lakesh ensured that it was continuously manned. Right now, there were eight other people sitting at workstations dotted around the room, a mixture of long-term Cerberus staffers and several from the more recent influx of personnel that the base had acquired from a cryogenic stasis squad found in the Menetius moon base. Almost immediately, Lakesh's eyes zeroed in on the black, metal-encased unit that Grant carried beneath one arm, and a confused frown furrowed his brow.
"Over the comm, you said you were bringing the important files you had located."
"And that's exactly what we've done."
Grant walked over to a free workstation and flipped the computer base from under his arm as though it didn't have any weight at all. Gently, he placed the computer on the desk and gestured to it theatrically.
"One computer full of important files."
Lakesh leaned forward, one hand reaching up to rest under his chin. Then he tilted his head, looking at the scarred computer from several angles.
"Highly irregular."
He turned back to his trusted field team, noticing for the first time how exhausted the three of them appeared.
"This is highly irregular. but doubtless it is of incalculable value.
Oh, it is. I skimmed over the bulk of the files before we left the Grand Forks base. I can't tell you what's on there, but it's encrypted to an almost implausible degree. It's got to be some important material.
It certainly sounds promising. Perhaps all of you would care to take a few hours for yourselves, while I make a start on accessing these files. Grant didn't need telling twice. He was already through the door and into the corridor without so much as a goodbye. Kane offered a half-hearted wave as he dashed out of the room after his partner, while Bridget Baptiste remained behind.
What do you think it contains? And more importantly, do you really think we can still access it? I told Kane this was an insane way of looking at the files, but he wouldn't hear of it.
Oftentimes there is an admirable directness to Kane's actions, I find.
Lakesh reached across the desk and pulled out several cables from the powered-down computer terminal located there. Bridget smiled. For all the apparent friction between herself and Kane, they were a good fit when push came to shove. Grant had reminded her earlier of the number of times that Kane had stepped in and put himself at risk to protect her and ensure that she reached her objective. She had done the same for him, of course. They were partners in peril. But there was more to it than that. A mystical bond that the two of them didn't speak of often. They were Anamkaras, soul friends, bonded throughout history to accompany each other as they faced whatever destiny threw at them. Bridget unzipped her sable-collared jacket and pulled out the spectacles she had tucked safely in the inside pocket during the rushed exit from the underground base in North Dakota.
What can I do to help?
She reached past Lakesh to unplug the keyboard from the unused computer terminal. He turned to watch her as she began searching for the right port at the back of the black box to insert the keyboard jack. He admired her utter focus and unwavering determination, feeling at that moment that he could watch her work forever. He stopped himself, blinking and remembering the task at hand.
Why don't you take a few minutes to wash up and get yourself a change of clothes, dearest Bridget? I can handle this, and I'm sure that the joint expertise in this room can likely pull me free if I get tangled in any loose wires.
Smiling, Lakesh gestured the breadth of the room, and Bridget looked up. Among the operatives at the terminals in the vast control center, she could see Brewster Filboid, an inspired astrophysicist of some renown, Dr. Mariah Falk, a caring woman and expert in the field of geology, and Donald Bry, the communications specialist who had helped get the satellites online. Lakesh was right. Among them, she realized these people could probably fashion a working computer from scratch given enough pieces. Bridget glanced at her reflection in the glass screen of the dead computer monitor before her, seeing her disheveled hair where it had been freed from the scarf, the mud-spattered white coat and scarf she still wore about her shoulders, and she realized that Lakesh had nothing but her own health at heart.
Yes, sirree, I'll take that advice.
She plucked the glasses from her nose and turned to the exit doors of the ops center.
But promise you'll call me the second you find anything, okay?
Kane hurried to catch up with Grant as he left the ops center. The redoubt's main corridor was a 20-foot-wide tunnel carved through the mountain rock, with curving ribs of metal and girders supporting its high roof.
What's the hurry, hero? You hardly said a word on the flight back here. Something on your mind?
Grant held up his left arm, fist clenched, and his wrist cron close to Kane's face.
I promised I'd cook for Suzuka tonight and didn't expect to be out in the field most of the afternoon.
Tilting his head, Kane looked at the wrist cron and noted that it was almost 6 o'clock.
So? Cooking is just cooking. It won't take that long.
Sure. Cooking will take no time at all. It's not the cooking that I'm worried about. Shower, shave, clean clothes. Gotta look my best.
Man, when did you two become such an old married couple? Listen to you.
Old married nothing. What are we doing all this for, Kane? What are we fighting this crazy-ass war for, if not for people like Suzuka?
He held Kane's gaze for a moment before turning and heading to his private quarters. Kane remained standing in the corridor, stunned and feeling suddenly very alone. The war. Sometimes he forgot about the war. When he was in point man mode, when it was all instinct, all action and do or die, he just went with the flow, didn't think too much about where it was all leading. But Grant was right. They were in the middle of a war. A war that had raged on the planet Earth for more than 5,000 years. An alien race called the Anunnaki had arrived on Earth in an effort to prevent their own stagnation. They had toyed with the primitive creatures that they had found there, shaping them to their own ends, for their own amusements. And when the toys had begun to lose their luster, the Anunnaki had unleashed a great flood to wash away the remnants of this childlike race called humanity and begin anew. New forms of terrestrial subjugation emerged, and humankind was once again exploited by the alien master race. Nobody really knew how long the Anunnaki had shaped world events, and no one really understood why an all-powerful race would take so much time over what were, to them, little more than insects. And yet, the Anunnaki had set events in motion to build up the Earth, only to have the great civilizations destroy each other in another cataclysm, this time seemingly of their own making. Where water had failed the first time, fire took its place. The planned nuclear holocaust had served a simple purpose, akin to leaving a field fallow so that the crops could be better harvested in the next cycle. The small percentage of the population that survived that fateful day in 2001 reverted to a state of savagery that ensured only the very strongest survived. 200 years after that first nuclear strike, the Anunnaki had reappeared as the overlords, reborn in new bodies formed from the chrysalis state of a mysterious ruling elite called the Barons. As far as Kane could understand it, the whole trick had been pulled through a computer download. An organic computer on a starship called Tiamat found orbiting Earth, utilizing vastly superior technology to regenerate the godlike Anunnaki pantheon. But for all intents and purposes, it was just another file download, a saved memory opened and accessed once more. And working with Bridget and Lakesh had taught Kane that one file download meant that you could do another. And another, and another, and another. Tiamat had taken a crippling hit during a recent squabble between different factions of the alien Anunnaki, and their tight grip on the affairs of Earth seemed to be relenting. But Kane suspected, as did all of the Cerberus exiles, that the chances were good that a backup file of Anunnaki personalities was just waiting to be downloaded. The threat had abated temporarily, but the war was far from over. Grant was right. He had Shizuka, the beautiful leader of a society of samurai warriors called the Tigers of Heaven, who inhabited New Edo and Thunder Isle in the Pacific. She was a noble warrior, every bit as brave and formidable as Grant. And who did Kane have? Who was his fight for?
Oh, the hell with it.
The ex-mag turned toward his own quarters to take a hot shower to loosen the kinks in his muscles. He didn't need to hang a face or a name on the person he was saving. He was there to save humanity, there to save himself and others like him. It wasn't a war. It was basic survival. As Lakesh attached a new keyboard to the recovered computer in the ops center, communications expert Donald Bry, sitting several seats across from him, thought he saw a quick flash of code whip across the monitor at his workstation. A round-shouldered man of small stature, Bry wore a constant expression of consternation, no matter his mood, beneath the curly mop of unruly, copper-colored hair. Bry was a long-serving and trusted member of the Cerberus crew, acting as Lakesh's lieutenant and apprentice in all things technological. Bry leaned forward in his seat, peering at his computer monitor, waiting for whatever it was to reappear. His computer was linked to the keyhole communications satellite, allowing Cerberus to remain in touch with field operatives and to pass information to them as required. As he watched the surveillance image with thermal overlay taking up the main window on screen, he urged whatever it was that had flashed up to reappear, but nothing happened. He then slid his chair a few feet along the desk to review the past 40 seconds at a separate monitor to his left. Nothing appeared to be out of the ordinary. No code, no flash, nothing. Turning back to the live feed, Donald Bry leaned forward once again and ran his index finger across the lower right-hand side of the screen, where he thought he had seen the code flash for a fraction of a second. Farrell leaned over from a nearby desk, a quizzical look on his face.
Everything okay, Donald?
I thought I saw something for a moment, but it was nothing. Just tired, I guess. Been looking at the screen too long.
Rest your eyes a bit. I'll take over communications monitoring for a while.
Thanks. I'll be back shortly.
As Bry passed him, Lakesh was hooking a new monitor to the recovered computer.
Be sure you save some of the action for me, Lakesh.
Bry exited the ops center into the vanadium steel corridor. Outside the operations center, Bry stood and rubbed a hand over his eyes.
What did I see?
Whatever it was, if it had been anything at all, had flashed across the screen so quickly that it had to have been there for no more than a nanosecond, utterly subliminal. If it had been anything at all, he reminded himself. On the plateau outside the heavy accordion-style doors to the Cerberus Redoubt, two figures were sparring. A rough circle had been etched in the dirt around them, stretching to a diameter of roughly 20 feet. The early morning sun was rising over the mountain, casting long shadows across the ground as the two combatants paced the edge of the marked area as they prepared to battle. The two figures could not have been more different. To one side of the circle stood Grant, the dark-skinned, heavily muscled ex-mag dressed in loose-fitting combat trousers and a dark-colored vest. His outfit was finished by a pair of scuffed black leather boots, a souvenir of his magistrate days. Across the circle, her bare feet crossing each other as she walked around the edge of the temporary arena, her eyes never leaving those of her opponent, was Domi. Lithe and thin, Domi was an albino, her skin chalk white and her short-cropped hair the cream color of bone. She wore an olive drab ensemble made up of an abbreviated halter top that barely covered her tiny, pert breasts, and a pair of shorts rolled up high in the leg. The most startling aspect of Domi's appearance, however, were her ruby-red eyes. The young woman weighed little more than a third of her opponent, yet showed no fear as she prepared to do combat with the bigger man.
First outside the circle, toss or misstep. Either counts as a loss.
I know the rules, Domi. Give it your best shot so I can toss your sorry ass out of here and get to the cafeteria in time to catch the decent breakfast shift.
In your dreams, Grant. I'm saving my best shot for someone good.
With that, Grant charged toward her, his boots kicking up dirt as he closed the space between them. Domi watched calmly, lightly balancing on the balls of her feet as this relentless juggernaut of a man hurtled toward her, his head down like a charging rhinoceros. She leaped perfectly, her hand whipping out to scuff momentarily across Grant's left shoulder where he held it low to the ground. Suddenly she was flipping into the air, her feet at the highest apex as she pivoted off the ex-mag's body. As graceful as a ballerina, behind Grant, Domi pulled her body into itself. With Domi out of his way, Grant saw the edge of the circle in the dirt just three steps ahead of him, and he rolled his body and slapped his right hand hard on the ground to bring himself to a bone-jarring halt. Grant righted himself, lifting his huge frame from where he had slid.
Ha! You're getting sloppy, old magman!
Crouched low to the ground, Grant turned to look at the thin-framed young woman. Domi, like Grant, Kane, and Bridget, had once been a denizen of Cobaltville, though her position as sex slave had been far less salubrious than that of the magistrates and the archivist. But circumstance had thrown them all together, a little unit that made up the solid core of the Cerberus exiles, together with Lakesh as their mission controller. These days, Domi was sleeping with mission control, but that was a different story altogether. As a child of the Outlands, she was naturally a loner, used to relying on her own wits and often abrupt around others, making them feel uncomfortable. But now and then, she missed true company, that inherent human need for social contact, and Grant and Kane had always shown nothing but respect for her, despite her background. Grant looked to where Domi stood in the center of the circle, and he noticed Kane was now standing a little way back from the circle's edge, over by the large doors to the redoubt. His eyes flicked to Domi once more, just standing there, waiting for his attack. Grant was a massive engine of muscle as he drove forward, swinging punches left and right as he closed in on Domi. She weaved back, ducking low, and swung her right leg out in a sweeping arc, attempting to trip the bigger man. The front of her calf slapped into the top of Grant's heavy boot and just stopped, like hitting a solid metal bar. Domi pulled her leg back and rolled her body out of the way of Grant's piledriver punches. Suddenly she was standing again, a blur of motion as she darted her outstretched hands at him, holding them flat like blades. Grant put up a rock-solid arm to halt her attack, blocking each blow between wrist and elbow as her hands flitted toward his face. He sensed the opening in her attack before he saw it, an old magistrate instinct, and his right leg kicked out as he pivoted at the torso, dropping low to ensure that his foot made solid contact. Grant's kick slammed Domi just beside the breastbone, and she staggered backward. She looked down and saw that she was just one footstep away from the edge of the circle that she had marked out before Grant arrived.
Not laughing so much now, huh?
Grant centered himself and walked warily toward her.
Don't worry. I'm still laughing on the inside.
And just what is that supposed to mean?
I don't know. It just seemed the thing to say.
Kane was still by the doors to the redoubt.
Blah, blah, blah. Are you kids gonna talk or are you gonna fight? I came here to see blood, people.
You want to finish this, Domi?
Ready when you are.
Kane stepped over to the edge of the circle, a little behind where Domi was trapped.
This is it, people. Beauty versus the Beast. My money's on Beauty there, but don't take offense. I've known him a lot longer than I have you, Domi.
Har har!
Not looking back, Domi took a step closer to Grant. Yeah! In a flash, Domi spun her body, swinging first her left leg and then her right in Grant's direction, repeating the action as he skipped back to avoid her kicks. Grant slapped her legs away from his face as he continued backward. Grant timed Domi's movements in his head, and suddenly his arm shot out and he grabbed her right ankle as it swung toward his face. Not expecting the move, Domi overbalanced and tumbled to the hard-packed ground, her momentum pulling Grant over with her. Together, the pair of fighters slammed into the dirt, with Grant spinning to avoid crushing Domi's bird-like frame beneath his massive build.
You okay?
Lying prone on the ground, Domi peered over her shoulder down the length of her body at Grant's concerned expression. His vest was darker now, she saw, where sweat had pooled between his pectoral muscles.
Yeah, I'm fine. Thanks.
Grant eased himself off the ground and stood over her, offering her one of his huge hands to help her up.
Aren't you gonna finish me off?
Grant shook his head, pointing to the ground at his feet.
I stepped outside the circle when I rolled.
Domi took his hand, a sour expression crossing her features.
Yeah, but you did that to avoid hurting me.
Still counts. Besides, breakfast is becoming a nagging priority just now. Tough to fight on an empty stomach.
Domi brushed herself down and watched Grant return to the redoubt and disappear into the darkness of the tunnel mouth. After a few moments, she turned to Kane, still standing at the side of the circle.
Did you want to see me?
Nah, I just came out here to get some peace and quiet. Didn't realize that Fight Club was in session this morning.
You want to fight?
Kane looked out over the plateau, watching as wispy cotton candy clouds drifted slowly over the distant sky, before he reached for the top of his shirt and began unbuttoning it.
What the hell? Why not? But no pulling hair, okay?
I won't if you won't.
Domi walked across to the far side of the dirt circle as Kane stepped in, dropping into a fighter's stance. He felt the nagging doubts of the past few days ebb away. It felt good to be alive.